From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 27th day of November, 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. The markets are open, however, I'm out of the office on holiday. Still, we'll talk with Mike Zuzulo, or at least we did on Wednesday afternoon, and we'll hear that. He's in Atchison, Kansas at globalcomresearch.com. And a bit later in the program, we'll hear an interview that I did with the chief of the crops branch at USDA NAS, Lance Honig, about the changes, the revisions that were made in the June stocks report when the September grain stocks report was released. That's come under some scrutiny as of late, and it'll happen here on the Closing Market Report.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Markets are open on this Friday, but of course I'm out of the office. It's a holiday here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I know Mike Zuzulo on this Friday has been working, but, we're talking with him on a Wednesday now. So, Mike, thanks so much for joining us early. I appreciate that. I hope you and your family had a great Thanksgiving. Can you give me a quick overview on Wednesday morning of how you see this marketplace?
Sure, and a blessed Thanksgiving to you and your family, Todd, and all the great people at Will Radio, who I've just grown to feel like they're family members to me, and especially to all the listeners out there who have been so loyal to us over these years. I think we're getting closer and closer to a market where, with the apparent look of a new president coming in and the reaction in the energy markets being so odd. In other words, a sharp rally in unleaded this week, a sharp rally in crude oil this week on COVID and on expectations of a fiscal stimulus bill to get rolled out relatively quickly versus a real hit to the ethanol markets really starts to, I think, frame up a marketplace where we're going to need to rely upon weather and export demand more and more and more to offset potentially a more negative macro market. This shouldn't be anything new. This is something you and I have talked about for several weeks now, and I just think the market is moving in that direction. And so when we go into Friday's trade, export sales are going to be extremely important. And then when we come back from Sunday in the Thanksgiving holiday, it's going to be extremely key that we got some good rains in South American areas in order for the bear to press his case. Otherwise, we could be right back on the long side of this market.
Yeah, so a couple of things. You're talking about demand for ethanol and corn usage on that front related to COVID and the financial outlook across the planet. And then you turn to the soybean market, a weather market, as you just explained, out of South America, and we'll have to wait and see what that looks like on Friday morning. Also, exports to China there, which on Wednesday, when we're talking, has said, you know, we're not sure we need all the beans that the United States is going to ship to us, apparently.
Yeah, and this was out in some segments in Chicago as early as Tuesday afternoon, but the trade didn't know what to make of it and didn't get around it, didn't seem like, which was very odd to me. But yeah, it sounds like that Chinese smaller crushers who are losing money right now, who had not set a futures price and kept option origin on their purchases, maybe washing out anywhere from 2 to 5 cargoes of soybeans. And that will be the number one thing to watch for Friday morning, in my opinion. I think the other thing that I have to address with Wednesday's trade is the really big break in the downside on the wheat market. And this is with the wheat conditions surprisingly dropping and going down to a point where we are in dire trouble in the hard red wheat belt. When you look at Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas and Colorado were all those states are well below last year in good to excellent conditions. And so you've got a market, I think, again, the wheat is showing more of the macro look, and it's showing the fact that the Russian ruble is hitting a 9-week low against the U.S. dollar. And I think that's why, in part, we've seen this wheat market give way as we went into the holiday. So the mindset I have basic terms, Todd, is we need to feed the bull as we come back from the weekend, the weather bull specifically. If we can do that, then we'll continue on the current path.
Well, I have a question. If we don't do that, and wheat tends to lead sometimes, but if we do not do that, what are the downside support areas for the marketplace that that you're working towards.
Yeah, and you're on them on Wednesday with the 590 area in soft red wheat and the 540 area in the hard red wheat. And this is where the wheat and the soybeans look very technically capable of dropping another 30 to 40 cents a piece. So a 30 to 40 cent break in soft red wheat and a 30 to 40 cent break in soybeans is not difficult to envision either. And I will say, you know, we talked about this probably last summer before the lead month beans were able to clear that 1045 level on a monthly close in October. We talked about before that happened that beans tend to like to move in 40 to 60 cent increments when it comes to how the funds treat us and how the percent gains and losses are. So that's what I would be looking at as a 40 to 60 cent break led by the wheat.
Domestically, can you give me your quick assessment of the soybeans? Because the crush from NOPA had been a record. That, of course, was not at this high a price. Will that change much?
I think it will. I mean, we've already seen the crush margins for lead month futures drop below a dollar a bushel, and that kind of puts me in the yellow zone for a slowdown. We're closing out the holiday or going into the holiday anywhere from 96 cents to $1.02. You stay above a dollar, you're in good shape. If you start making new monthly lows, though, I think that really does open up the door for a rapid slowdown in the crush. How rapid? Well, it depends on the weights and the cattle and especially the hogs and chickens. Cold storage numbers would say we still need to produce. So, but I think that the record high NOPA crush numbers are a thing of the past if we start dropping well below a dollar a bushel on crush.
Hey, thanks for doing this early for me on Wednesday, and I hope, again, that you and your family have a great Thanksgiving holiday.
You too, Todd. Thanks, and we got a lot of blessings to be thankful for.
Mike Zuzulo is with GlobalCommResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, joined us on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand. We're at willag.org, willag.org. Up next, you know, the tools and the equipment on the farm can be really hard to use and a struggle for many people to handle. That's even worse for the female population, as generally they're smaller than men. Dana Cronin has been thinking about that some. She's a reporter at Illinois Public Media, focusing on agriculture, and she files this report.
Dusty Spurgeon has a love-hate relationship with her tractor. She helps run Spurgeon Veggies, a small vegetable farm in Ryo, Illinois, along with her mother-in-law. As a woman-owned and operated business, one of the biggest hurdles they face is the equipment they farm with. Starting with the tractor. Tractors are often used to pull different implements for plowing, for planting, or for harvesting. Switching those out is not easy. You often need a lot of upper body strength.
You are pushing this thing forward to fit it onto that part, and then you have to get it all the way on, which is really freaking hard.
Frustrating. Spurgeon uses that word over and over again.
I hate it. I hate it. It makes me feel incompetent. I can't do my job.
It's not just changing the implements on the tractor. It's everything about the way the tractor is designed. She finds the parking brake almost impossible to engage. The fuel tank is located at the top of the tractor, meaning she has to lift a heavy fuel can up above her head to gas up. The tractor also has a safety bar that needs to be up in case it flips. It's a very heavy bar.
Oh, oh my God.
Spurgeon says she's lucky that she's taller and stronger than the average woman.
If you were a 5'1" woman trying to put the roll bar thing up or change out the PTO or whatever, I don't know that it would be possible to do without the pretty major potential for injury.
Many of these features are hard for everyone to use. Spurgeon is the first to admit that. But women are at a particular disadvantage, says Josie Rudolfi, who researches agricultural safety and health at the University of Illinois.
These were designed for, people of a certain weight and certain height, pretty much reflective of the male population in the United States.
She says farming is already a dangerous job, and for women, the potential for injury is high. So some are stepping in to help. Ann Adams and Liz Brensinger own Green Heron Tools, which has trademarked the term hergonomic. Their tools, designed for women, are generally lighter, have patented grips to accommodate smaller hands, and come in a variety of sizes. Adams and Brensinger are farmers themselves and got frustrated with the lack of female-friendly tools on the market.
I mean, there were companies that painted crappy tools pink and called them ladies' tools, but we couldn't find a single case of tools or equipment in the ag sector that had been scientifically designed to work well for women.
Brensinger says women have always played an important role on the farm, and that role only continues to grow. According to the most recent USDA Ag Census data, about 36% of all farmers are female, and that number has been steadily increasing for the past decade.
To have women playing this important role and having to use tools and equipment that don't fit them, that, you know, aren't going to work as well for them as they need something to, and that might actually hurt them, there's just something really wrong with that picture.
She says this is a public health and safety issue, and until female-friendly tools are more widely available, farmers like Dusty Spurgeon will continue to put their bodies at risk to accomplish everyday farm tasks. I'm Dana Cronin, Illinois Newsroom.
Have you signed up yet for the Illinois Farm Economics Summit series? I hope so, but if not, you can do that on our website at willag.org, or at least find the registration page and all the information and details. The Agricultural Economist and I will be hosting a series of 5 webinars. They're just an hour long, starting next Tuesday and running Tuesday, Friday, and Tuesday through the 15th day of December. Sign up for one and you're signed up for all of them. Register now at willag.org. It's free. That's right, it's free this year. So don't wait. Get yourself registered. More than 900 folks have already signed up. Won't you join them for the Illinois Farm Economics Summits? You can find all the details on our website, or at least a link to the details. Look for the Illinois Farm Economics Summit, or go directly to the Farm Doc Daily website, either willag.org or farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. The chief of the crops branch at USDA NAS now joins us, Lance Honig. Lance, thanks for being with us, and thanks for being at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention virtually, not in Kansas City, but all across the Midwest. We appreciate that. How are things in D.C.?
Hey, you know, it's good. The weather's been great, and, you know, we're just happy for an opportunity to, even if it's in a virtual environment, to be able to get together and visit with some of these important farm broadcasters across the country.
One of the things that has been a topic of discussion since the grain stocks numbers were reported was some of the changes that actually came in that period, and you know, a fairly substantial drop from last year and what was left over. Can you tell me a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, and I think, you know, probably the biggest change that came out of those numbers that people have really asked a lot of questions about is the revision that we made to the June 1 stock, specifically for corn. And of course, we're talking about in the September period. You know, a couple of things I'll point out. Number one, the previous quarter, in this case, which would be June, but the previous quarter stocks are always subject to revision when we publish a new grain stocks report. So from a procedure standpoint, there was no change there. We did make a change this year in September, moving the opportunity to revise the previous season's production numbers. That was the procedural change that we made, but that's not the situation that we're talking about here, because it was a revision that we made to the previous stocks number back in June. And like I say, that was not a change to the process that we had. We've always had the previous quarter open. What's different is the magnitude of the change was larger than what we've seen historically. And so naturally, that's had folks asking a few questions about, you know, exactly why the change was larger this time than it's been in the past.
Then do you have a good answer?
Well, you know, apparently not a great answer, because the questions keep coming in, but I'll, you know, certainly do my best to try to talk through that. And so I think what makes it a little bit confusing is because it's not that we had new data specifically for June. The situation is that now we've got the September data. So you've got that following quarter information. And now that opens the door to looking at additional relationships that you wouldn't have been able to see when you were back in the June time period, because you didn't see that next quarter's information yet. So anytime that we look at our stocks information, we're not only looking at a measure of how many bushels are on hand, but we calculate these various relationships to the previous quarter. We look across the entire season to date and look at various data relationships, whether it's disappearance information. Of course, we're always looking at a balance sheet. So we've got updated information on imports, exports, usage, things of that nature. And so with that additional look at the data, knowing what September now is, it forced us to reconsider the level that we had set in June. And anytime you collect information from a survey, there's going to be a bit of a range around those indicated levels that you get. And so the more information you have, it helps you really fine tune where that best estimate is in that range of indications that you have that satisfies all the relationships that exist. And that's exactly what we saw this time. You know, as to why the data fell a little bit further out of line than what we had previously seen this year compared to what we've seen in the past, I don't know. We just know that we make data-driven decisions, and the data that we had told us that the best fit for that estimate was to move a bit more than what we've seen historically.
Yeah, so the magnitude of the data, the change, was the issue. And I'm wondering, when you looked at that data and saw what the grain stocks that were actually on hand were from all the sources that you survey, or the census side of it, relatively speaking, that you had to go back and say, well, there's no possible way that the June number couldn't have been lower. And so feed use had to be greater in that quarter than we expected. Is that where that ends up? I'm trying to get a handle on how the use went.
Well, a little bit. And so a couple of points I'll make there. Number one, I wouldn't say had to be or couldn't be. We really look at it more, again, as a best fit. And so it's not that the previous number was, I guess, impossible, but it wasn't the best number based on the relationships that we were seeing. And then the second point I would make is that, you know, I just want to be clear that we do not estimate feed and residual. So it's not that we looked and said, we think the feed and residual value should be this. We don't know. There is no measure of feed and residual that I'm aware of. Because there's just not enough information out there to tell you about it. However, you can look at what you might think of as reasonable ranges where that data can fall. And so when you start to see ranges for disappearance or feed-in residual that just don't look like anything you've seen in the past, that tends to lead you to think maybe some adjustments need to be made in the estimates to help bring those things more in line with what you've seen historically. But again, we did not set a feed and residual number for that quarter or any other, but we do look at those numbers and how they compare relative to past years, past quarters. We look at livestock inventory levels and look for reasonableness.
You have three calculations, I guess, in that process. Ethanol demand, which you can see and track. Exports, which you can see and track. And then you have the stocks number, and you put them all back together. So you just ended up with this last stocks number saying, well, exports didn't appear to be that good. We know what the ethanol demand looked like. So you had to do some changes.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we felt like. We needed to make some changes. And, you know, those changes turned out to be larger than what you would normally see. We've seen a little bit more volatility. And I think there's been a lot of talk about that too over the last year and a half. It just seems like some of these relationships have been a little bit more volatile than what we've seen historically. You know, I'm as curious about why some of that's happening as anybody else is. We're certainly continuing to take a close look at our processes and procedures to make sure that, you know, if there's any improvements we can make to help identify any of these situations earlier, we're going to do that. But, you know, our process hasn't changed. And so, you know, has the industry changed such that maybe we need to make some adjustments? We're always looking at that. And we're certainly doing it now.
This is not unprecedented, though. It was a 205 million bushel change? Yeah, there was a point in the past where 300 million bushels in the past was coming in and out of those stocks numbers on a fairly regular basis, and not a change in the previous quarter.
Yeah, and I think the difference is probably that in the past, what we've been talking about is maybe the estimate for the current quarter coming in 200 or 300 million bushels above or below where folks would have expected those numbers to come in. And here we're talking about literally going back and revising the previous quarter by a magnitude of that level. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, you're right. I mean, in that sense, it's not unprecedented to see that magnitude of difference, but just in where and how it was implemented was a bit different than we've seen in the past.
So what caused that difference rather than just putting it in the current quarter as opposed to changing the previous quarter?
You know, each measure that we get for an individual quarter, as I mentioned, there's some range around those values, what would be acceptable based on the information that we've gathered. And so you've got to kind of wiggle it between both quarters. And there really, with the data that we had collected in September, there wasn't, quote, room to just move that number, you know, to account for that whole difference. There, you have to kind of balance the two quarters and the information that you've collected from both producers and the commercial facilities. And we've got statistical ranges around that data. And so you've got to balance what fits both data points. And this was what fit both data points in June and in September.
Finally, because you did change some of the procedural things last year, and what normally would have been done in January for corn is now done in September, just like it is done for soybeans in September. Does this mean in January there won't be any revisions, or there's not an opportunity for revisions again?
So the change was to the previous year's production. And so any consideration of revising the 2019 corn production, that already happened now. Those adjustments were made and published in the September grain stocks report, just as we do with soybeans. So come January, we will not be looking to make any revisions to the 2019 corn production numbers. Now, as I mentioned, from a stocks perspective, we always open the previous quarter to revision. So there's certainly a possibility that the September 1 stocks could be revised in the grain stocks report that comes out in January, because that's what the process dictates. But, you know, are there going to be changes? We don't know. It'll be data driven, and we don't have the data yet. And so we'll certainly analyze that just like we do every other quarter.
Hey, Lance, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Todd.
That's Lance Honig, the chief of the crops branch at USDA NASS. We caught up with him during the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City. Stay with us. Commodity Week is coming up next right here on Illinois Public Media.